You're listening to our Great Divorce podcast, where we walk through one of C.S. Lewis's greatest works and discuss practically what it means for our lives today. This podcast was produced by St. Andrew in Plano, Texas. The theme song you're hearing is Shadow to Sunlight by Micah Peacock. For more information about our church and the different ministries we provide, or to find other podcasts we have produced, we invite you to visit standrewumc.org or join us for worship on Sunday mornings.
So glad to have you back, continuing in the podcast about the Great Divorce. As always, I've got Forrest here to make sure that I'm interesting and relevant. We're about to go into the most interesting, most relevant chapter, at least in my book.
I think you've said that about every chapter we've covered.
Well, that's exactly what I do about scriptures too, right? Like, how many scriptures have I, like, when I'm preaching, goes, this one's my favorite. This one's my favorite. Well, this is my favorite story today. So we're going to start halfway through chapter 11. And if you remember in the last episode, we had a conversation about a mother who lost her child, and it was a pretty tragic and sad story. I want to highlight that story before we go into the next one, because I believe that C.S. Lewis is trying to get us to understand love properly. And love properly is actually a very difficult thing to do. And there are lots of ways to mess it up. There are ways to mess it up where it's really about us. So, like, sometimes as parents, we think that love for our kids is actually more about us than it is about real love, which is selflessly caring for someone else. And so you've got this mom who actually poorly loved her child and damaged her husband and daughter in trying to preserve the love that she had for her lost child. Today, we're going to transition to the second half, and we wanted to separate these chapters out as episodes because the second one, while it's still about love, has a very different tenor. It's a very different tenor about actually lust and a cheapened form of love, a love that is insubstantial next to what God is actually calling us to do. I do want to go back to one phrase from the first half of the chapter 11. There's a phrase where it says, I hate your religion and I hate and despise your God. I believe in a God of love. And the response from the solid person is, and yet you have no love for your own mother or for me. And there's an entire section here, right? The ghost, like, pulls them away right after this conversation to transition to the story about lust. And I believe that's really one of the difficulties that we have in our life and understanding the Bible. And really, I think understanding the connection between the Great Divorce and Scripture is a proper understanding of love is one that is way deeper than the way we normally use it in our world today.
Why do you think he carried over that story into chapter 11?
I think because Lewis thinks in categories. So Lewis is an English professor who is trained in myths and is really trying to narrow down on that question of love. There are other pieces where, like, someone who basically wanted their art or someone who wanted their prestige or someone to be known. And this is a whole section on what love really ought to be.
I was just saying, I think it's funny that we decided it's better to tell these stories in separate episodes, but he carries it over and does it in one.
Yeah. But I think we as normal people and not C.S. Lewis, although to be fair, no one's ever called me normal. So we'll just
use that term loosely.
I do use that term loosely. I think we imagine them as different things. And it's really hard to go from the loss of a child to talking about lust. That's not a normal transition in any conversation I've ever had. And yet, if you're thinking about the categories where love is this grand idea, and yet we mess it up, we cheapen it. Because here's the way we do love. It's not like we reject love in the world. We just try to redefine it. And in our redefinition, we make it less. And so that's really what the truth for the way in which, frankly, a lot of parents love their children, a lot of the way husbands and wives love each other. And frankly, in trying to find a two-dimensional reality of love, which is what we call lust. I think those are all different ways that that gets played. So the interesting one is this is also one of those sections where it gets a little bit more mystical and weird, because lust here is personified by literally a lizard on the guy's shoulder.
They don't explain that it's lust to the end, though.
No, they don't explain it's lust. So
like the whole time you're reading it, you're like, what in the world is this lizard doing?
Spoilers, I suppose. But you're right. There is this lizard on top of him and kind of attached to him, like on his shoulder. Funny enough, it's the way we typically think about the devil, like the devil being on one shoulder.
I was picturing a parrot on a pirate shoulder, but...
That's funnier. Yeah. I'll go with a parrot on a pirate's shoulder. But here's how he describes love. Love, as mortals understand the word, isn't enough. Every natural love will rise again and live forever in this country, but none will rise again until it has been buried. You ought to think about this in terms of like baptism, where we connect our sins, our cheapened form of love. It's got to be buried. It's got to actually die to itself before it can rise from the grave, which is why I think the question of love and the death and the resurrection of Jesus, why this section mirrors the Bible so well when it comes to what we actually mean about love. Here's how he describes this person. The guy says, I saw towards us a ghost who carried something on his shoulder. Like all ghosts, he was unsubstantial, but they differed from one another as smokes differ, which is only a distinction that C.S. Lewis would try to write. Anyway, he said, what sat on his shoulder was a little red lizard, and it was twitching its tail like a whip. I think that's really interesting. The whip is like, you know, chaining him, like a master driving him or whatever, and whispering things into his ear. And there's this battle that you can see between the smoky guy and the lizard on his shoulder, because he goes, shut up, I tell you. You can tell that there's this internal battle between what this person wants to be and this thing that is literally attached to their shoulder. And in fact, the solid person who's there to chat with him says, off so soon? He goes, yes, I'm off. Thanks for all your hospitality, but it's no good. I told this little guy that he would have to be quiet if he came. Now, this is why we know it's lust, because we've read the end of the chapter. Mm-hmm. But this is where you're like, why is a lizard showing up? Which is, by the way, the weirdness of this book and why people have a hard time getting through it is you've got to go back and realize, oh, it's lust. And frankly, I think this definition of lust, and I think this could be true of any of our sins, whether it's alcoholism or lust or greed or whatever it is. Like, I think he chose lust because he's in a section on love in this bit. But could easily be greed, where you're like, hey, shut up. I don't need any more. I don't want any more. Or it could be prestige. Hey, shut up. I don't have to be well known. And yet it's just this thing that's on you. And you think all it has to do is just be quiet and you'll be okay. And you don't realize that what the Christian story is, what Jesus offers, is something far better and deeper and harder than just quieting your lust or your greed or your desire for something.
I also noticed, weirdly for the first time, I think I should have understood this, but he says he limped westward away from the mountains. The first time I was oriented in heaven on which way is which.
Well, so Lewis actually does this a lot, where in Chronicles of Narnia, actually heaven is in the east. It's really interesting. Yeah. In Lewis's framework, because the sun rises in the east, yeah, it is always where heaven actually is.
I noticed that. It was weird.
It's cool. Well, if you read the Chronicles of Narnia, there's a whole bit in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader where a little creature named Rip-a-Cheep seeks utter east, which is actually heaven.
I'll get back to you after I read that.
He's never going to read that. All right. So here's the question. Would you like me to make him quiet? The ghost responds, well, of course I would. And the angel says, well, then I'll kill him. I love this bit.
It's like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. I didn't actually mean that. I kind of like my desires. I kind of like my little thing that's hanging out of my shoulders. And he goes, oh, you're burning me. Keep away. And the question here is, what do you really want? Do you want to be burdened by your particular issue? I think we all have these issues. And it's why I think this chapter is so relevant, is it may be lust for many people. It also could be a whole host of other things. Significance, wealth, being needed, whatever it is, there's this thing that I think we carry on ourselves. And the angel looks at us and says, do you want it to be quiet? We're like, of course I want it to be quiet. Well, great, then I'll kill it.
Not that quiet.
Not that quiet. Here's his response. You didn't say anything about killing him at first. I hardly meant to bother you with something as drastic as that. And the angel responds, it's the only way. Shall I kill it? There's this like driving question of, do you really want this gone? Are you prepared to lose part of yourself, part of how you understand yourself to be? Even if it's like not actually part of yourself and a lizard, are you prepared to do what it takes? It's the only way. Shall I kill it? And then there's this continual back and forth of, well, I mean, I'm quite open to consider it, but it's a new point. I mean, if I was only thinking about silencing it.
Anybody who's been a Christian for any amount of time has had this negotiation in a prayer. You know, like you realize something's going on and you're just like, Lord, take this from me, kind of, like, not all the way.
There's a famous theologian, I think it's Augustine, who says, Lord, make me chaste, but not yet.
Yeah.
Like, Lord, make me sober, but not today.
Yeah.
Lord, make me charitable, but after I get what I want.
Well, there's also the famous theologian, Kenny Chesney, that sings the song, Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, but Nobody Wants to Go Now. It's like, yeah, that sounds great, but I kind of like what I'm dealing with.
And here's the question, I think, if every Christian has had this conversation with God, this negotiation with God, what's really the question is about timing. And that's the question that happens right here. May I kill it? And he says, well, there's just time to discuss that later. And the angel responds, there is no time. May I kill it? And he continues and he says, well, I think the gradual process, which frankly is one that I think we also, every Christian has done, like, well, I'm going to be greedy, but I'm going to be a little less greedy today. Frankly, I will say this actually has a lot to do, I think, with greed as well as lust and all this, because I think there's a lot of desire among people, like when it comes to tithing or whatever, let me do it gradually. And you're like, gradually just makes it harder every year than just deciding this is who I am and this is what I'm going to be. Or great. So you're having an affair on your wife. Great. You'll just do it every other week now instead of every week. I'm sorry. That's not actually the right strategy.
A little less intense, but still relevant. This is how I start diets.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, I'm pretty much always starting a diet here in the next week, but I think everyone agrees you don't start a diet on a weekend. Like, it's Monday is the day you start the diet, right? Like, nobody starts a diet on a Sunday morning or
even though there's
Friday.
No difference between a Friday and a Monday for your body.
But there is for your body, but there's a difference. But then it's like, well, if it's that important to you, then just...
Well, see, my problem is if you say Monday, then you're going to go, oh, man, but I got to deal with that person at work. So I'm going to do it Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday.
But then you can't start a diet on Tuesday. You start a diet on Monday. So if you miss Monday, then you got
to wait a whole other week. So to the point, the angel says the gradual process is of no use at all. And I think that's true for a lot of things. Just be who you want to be. Be who God has called you to be. Let God kill what you believe God ought to kill. It says, I'm not feeling frightfully well today. It'd be most silly to do it now. That's how I feel every time I start like some kind of new workout project or whatever. It'd be silly to do it today. Tomorrow morning's definitely the better time. But here in heaven, and this is really why Lewis's vision of heaven is so cool to me, is because when you realize that earth is simply the footstool of heaven, as it says in the preface, that actually in the end, this won't be a distinct thing. All moments are contained in this moment. It says there is no other day. All days are present now. There's this kind of desire that says, well, actually, if earth and heaven are kind of this long journey that we're on, well, then start heaven today. Reject what you know is not good for you and choose heaven literally today. And finally, he goes, you think I'm a coward, but it isn't that. Let me run back by tonight's bus and I'll get an opinion from my own doctor. I'll come again the first moment I can. And here's the phrase, this moment contains all moments. Where really, that's the truth of every single thing that's good for you or bad for you is it's not like you're going to be a different person an hour from now than you are today, or that you're going to actually want to do the diet or want to stop lusting or want to stop having greed. Here's what I know. At every moment, there's one thing that every single person is sitting there going, man, I'd be a better husband, father, person if I did that or stopped that. And that's why I like this phrase of this moment contains all moments. This is just a question of who you are, of who you want to be. Anyway, I think that's a really powerful phrase here. So it continues, if you wanted to help me, why didn't you kill the damned thing without asking me? Before I knew, it would all be over by now. And he says, I cannot kill it against your will. It is impossible. Have I your permission? Have I your permission? I know it will kill me. Well, suppose it did. Suppose you did die. Wouldn't that be better than living a lesser kind of existence? And he says, well, then damn and blast you. Go on, can't you? Get it over with. And the ghost gave a scream because the angel comes and rips the lizard aside and kills it and throws it to the ground. I love this portion, but this is also where it loses people because the angel takes the lizard, kills it, throws it to the ground. And here's the description. He twisted it while it bit and writhed and flung it broken-backed on the turf. For a moment, I could make out nothing distinctly. Then I saw between me and the nearest bush, unmistakably solid but growing every moment solider, the upper arm and shoulder of a man, and the brighter still and stronger, the legs and the hands. The neck and the golden head materialized while I watched. He's describing someone who, when he allowed to let lust die, allowed to let that desire and that pain die, he was able to actually become a different person, a better person, someone who was more solid and more real. And what distracted me was the fact at the same time, something was happening to the lizard. At first, I thought the operation failed. So far from dying, the creature was still struggling and even growing bigger as it struggled. And it turns out the lizard becomes a stallion. And that's where I think we lose most people in this chapter is they're like, "What? There's a lizard. Now it's a stallion. What just happened?" Here's what you end up realizing. And really, this comes from the next conversation with George McAfee and all this whole bit. The narrator says, "I don't really quite know it all, sir." And he says, "Am I right in thinking the lizard really turned into a horse?" And he says, "Aye, but it was killed first. You'll not forget that part of the story." This is the piece that is truly profound for me. Because it means that what happened was that piece of ourselves, which is so close to us, which is so deep in our soul, which we can't imagine being a human without our desires or lusts or whatever it is that makes ourselves that's less than who God called it to be. Actually, it doesn't need to just be quieted or changed a little. It needs to do what happens when we baptize people. The metaphor of baptism is actually really simple. You die to yourself. You reject your former life. You repent of your sin, which means you turn a different direction. You find a different way forward. And those things which were broken in your life end up becoming things of beauty, things of realness, things of joy. I mean, honestly, so like alcohol is one of those things that I really think about a lot in this chapter, because I know a lot of people for whom they were a shadow of who God meant them to be when they were in the throes of their alcoholism. And they couldn't just drink a little less. They had to fundamentally change who they were. And when they died to their former self, now, frankly, they're different people. And what was a piece of shame for them is now part of the reason why they live their life. In our congregation, we have some people for whom they've got some pretty tragic stories about shame for their past. And now they're people I point to as some of the best evangelists, some of the best witnesses, some of the best disciples that God has ever had, because their alcoholism, which they would still say they wrestle with, it's not like it's completely done on this side of the grave, but they get to leverage their past brokenness for greater glory than we could ever imagine. And it's not that God ever wanted that in the past,
right,
but it's that God doesn't waste the brokenness.
You know those people you see that just kind of glow?
Mm-hmm.
Like we talk about joy in the next chapter, but there's people like they've got some story, they got something that helped them get to where they are, and that God's leverage, just like you're saying.
Honestly, that's part of how I think about my life with my divorce. I was so ashamed of it, my brokenness, my past, etc. And the truth is, while it's not what God would have wanted, like God really has leveraged that past brokenness to be a stallion in my ministry. Like there are people who said, "I would never have trusted you had you not known that level of brokenness." And I'm like, it's just so intuitive. I ended up having a conversation with a bunch of divorced people once here at the church. We were thanking God for our broken past and going, this is a little weird, right? Because no one in the circle believed that God wanted our divorces to happen. And yet all of us on this side of it were thanking God for it. It was the weirdest mind bender I've ever been in. And I've known that's true for people for whom they've committed affairs or lust or whatever it is. Brokenness, when properly repented of, can become actually a joy and a place of beauty that God uses every day. So here's the ending bit about love to kind of tie the last episode and this one together. Am I to tell them at home that this man's sensuality proved less of an obstacle than that poor woman's love for her son? For that was, at any rate, an excess of love. This is the woman who didn't love her son enough. And he says, you'll tell him no such thing. Excess of love, did you say? There was no excess, there was defect. She loved her son too little, not too much. If she loved him more, there'd be no difficulty. I do not know how her affair will end. You must ask if the risen body, even of an appetite, basically the lust, is as grand as a horse as you saw, what would the risen body of maternal love or friendship be? Basically, the question is, Lust is a tiny thing that can keep us from heaven. Don't get me wrong, but it's tiny. It's a pathetic form of love, barely even mentioning the name of it. But if we have love for our spouse or our child or our parents or a friend that is not where it ought to be, imagine how beautiful the redemption of that story will be. That's, I think, how I wanted to end this section on love as we jump to joy next episode. But it's teaching me to wait. Got no place, but I know just why I'm here. Lift me out of the waste, keep me steady in the face of fear. I wanna swim in the deepest ocean. I wanna feel heaven come alive. I wanna find all that I've been missing. Tear down the